You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Alex Toku Ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Ratu Tuesday. I'm your host Alex and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in studio by producer Liam. E whaiake nei coming up on the show. For Dear Science this week, our expert Professor Alan Blackman speaks with us about politics and expertise, solar storms and trees, and droughts in New Zealand. For our weekly catch-up with the National Party, I spoke with MP Ryan Hamilton about the state of the social media ban for under-16s, the Prime Minister's comments about immigration, and the upcoming budget. Producer Liam, for Greenworld, spoke to Professor Nicholas Lewis about the government's plan to disestablish the Ministry for the Environment and merge it into a combined ministry for cities, environment, regions, and transport, and what effects this will have in the short and long term. He aha o whakaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or Waiamai Rane, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Ko wā e ware ware, e ahe ana koutou, te whakarongo ke ēne kōrero āno, hei pakehere roki roki mā runga I te pai, tuku tuku o Irirangi Pōho, me haere ki 95BFM, irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Kia tīmata te whakatūranga, let's get into the show.
Wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
For Dear Science this week, we're joined by our expert, Professor Alan Blackman. Alan, how are we today?
Well, this is going to be very meta, I've just realised, because you've called me an expert. I'm not sure I warrant that. But we're going to be talking about whether we should or whether we do trust experts. So you're going to have a supposed expert talking about whether you trust experts. So
what if we can't trust you?
Exactly. That's exactly it. So the question today, well, the first question is, you know, do we trust qualified people? Do we trust experts? And I think anybody who's been paying attention over the last, 8 years or so, will probably see a gradual erosion, I think, of trust in so-called experts. And so some workers in the States set out to see whether this was the case or not, whether we are trusting experts less. And this paper has just been published in the journal Scientific Reports. And do we trust qualified people? The answer is sometimes. Okay. Sort of a yeah, but no sort of thing. So what they did, they had a whopping 2,400 participants. And they did a three-part experiment with these. So they sort of cut them into three sections. So in the first experiment, they took 208 of these 2,400 people, and they asked them what factors they thought were important when evaluating an expert. And these experts were on topics as various as skincare, nutrition, abortion, and police brutality. So you've got a bit of a mix there.
Good to get a wide range.
Absolutely. And so the answers that sort of came through You know, what are they looking for in an expert on these subjects? They're looking for people that have, say, relevant degrees. They're looking for people who've got research experience in these particular topics. They're looking for, you know, things like peer recognition, moral character, all of those sort of things that you would sort of expect. And things like height, looks, race, and sexual orientation didn't really come into the equation, okay? So, you know, they're looking for qualifications. They're looking for people who obviously know something about whatever it is that they're talking about. So that was part one of the experiment. Part two, then they took 498 of the remaining people and they gave them fictional biographies of supposed experts, and in which the credentials of those experts were systematically varied, okay? And so, again, what they found, that most of them would trust people that had the relevant academic backgrounds. They're looking for experience. Again, they're looking for peer-recognized accomplishments, things like that. Again, you know, the sort of things that you would expect. Something like an Ivy League diploma, not a degree, but a diploma. Something like having lots of followers on social media, that also sort of came into the equation, but again, it wasn't sort of rated quite so highly as, you know, having proper degrees and proper experience and stuff like that. So again, so far so good, just probably what you would expect. Then came the clincher. The remaining 1,776 people, I don't know whether that's just totally accidental or not, seeing it's the 250th of the US. So 1,776 people. So they got them to read biographies of a fictional researcher who had written a best-selling book on abortion, okay? And so they said, right, so the researcher, the person that wrote the book supposedly was either a highly qualified doctor with lots of experience, or they were a mechanical engineer with minimal experience, okay? And the views of the researcher were also varied as well. So the researcher, the person that wrote the book, was either pro-choice, pro-life, or their preferences weren't stated, okay? Mm. Right, so, and in doing this, what they found was the most important factor on trusting the person that wrote the book was whether or not the person reading the book agreed with the views of the person who had written the book, regardless of their credentials, regardless of their experience or whatever, okay? So, sadly, it's all coming down to politics, okay? So what they found, for example, so the mechanical engineer who had the same views as the reader, even though he didn't have any expertise in the field, as long as he had the same views as the reader trusted them just as much as the doctor who hadn't stated their views, okay? So the doctor's not taking a position either way. The mechanical engineer, if he's got the same views as the reader, then the reader agrees with them, okay? They trust them just as much as a doctor, for goodness sake. And a doctor who has a quote-unquote wrong opinion, the opposite opinion from the reader, okay, is trusted no more than the mechanical engineer. So all of a sudden, all of this credential stuff goes totally out the window, and it all comes down to your political views, because that's what this is ultimately. And that, to me, is scary.
Yeah, maybe not the best when you're trying to get expert advice.
You know, and this is not like, this is not a small scale thing. You know, this is 2,400 participants. This is a decent whack of people. And this is what they find, that people are swayed by opinion, essentially. They're not looking at facts. And, I mean, this is just, sadly, it's self-evident in the way that the United States is going at the moment, when you've got people like, you know, Kennedy and stuff in charge of health, you know, who has absolutely no credentials in that.
But he agrees with them.
But anybody who agrees, oh, yeah, I'll take my ivermectin. Absolutely I will, you know.
And yeah.
Boy, what they said at the end of the paper is that they haven't, you know, that humanity hasn't lost complete trust in experts, but what they seem to be doing is they're looking for people that they agree with, and hence the rise of podcasters, influencers, all of these sort of social media-y type people and everything who are espousing a view, regardless of whether they've got any, you know, experience in that whatsoever, you know. And To me, this is a worry. This is a huge worry.
Yeah, not a particularly positive trend for trusting the science.
Well, you know, why be qualified then in that case? What's the point? What's the point if people aren't going to trust you? And so somehow we've got to get that trust back. And where the hell do you start with that? I mean, you can seemingly demonstrably prove these people to be wrong, but that just doesn't seem to cut any ice in the current political climate. Mm. It just doesn't. You know, people can tell. Well, people, like, I mean, you know, the president of the USA can just tell bald-faced whoppers, and people believe them. You know, regardless of the evidence, doesn't matter. And that's not good for humanity, folks. That's not good.
Was this all people in the study, or was some?
Well, this was. Yeah, no. This seemed to be the majority view. This seemed to be the whoa. That seemed to be the thing. So, a real worry. So.
Yeah, not a particularly joyous start to science today.
And
but
unfortunately,
it's important.
There's no easy answers out there, as far as I can see.
It's going to be something we're going to have to work on as a society. I feel, hopefully. Let's hope and pray that it could maybe get better.
Yes, indeed. Oh well. Anyway, onto better things.
What else? What else do you have for us today?
Well, again, if you're going to trust me when I tell you this, you know, I mean. So let's talk about solar storms, because they're pretty cool. I've never actually been up to see the Northern Lights. Unfortunately, have you guys ever been?
No.
You know, I'd love to see that. Apparently, it's absolutely utterly breathtaking. We don't quite get the same things down here. But they result from sort of solar storms. So they're high energy particles that come out of the sun. They interact with the Earth's atmosphere and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we get all these beautiful colours and stuff. And we certainly know when they're happening. You know, they can interfere with sort of communications and stuff. And if they are sufficiently intense, then if you're up in space in a spacecraft, it can kill you. Which isn't good. And apparently during the Apollo mission, so between Apollo 16 and Apollo 17, there was a massive solar storm. And basically, if they'd been on their way to the moon at that stage, then they'd be fried. So it is dangerous. And we obviously would like to know more about them.
So we cannot get fried.
Yeah, basically, yes. Yeah, which means being able to figure out when they occurred in the past, which is not quite so straightforward.
It doesn't seem like the easiest bit of science in the world.
No, because they don't necessarily leave tracks as well, they kind of do, as we're going to talk about, okay? So what these researchers in Okinawa in Japan have done, this is really, really quite cool. So they have used a mixture of science and literature to be able to pinpoint a solar storm that occurred between the winter of the year 1200 and the spring of the year 1201. Which to me seems pretty darn good to be able to narrow something down to that level of precision, which is really, really seriously good. So how did they do this? Well, so what they did was, the science part was carbon-14. Okay, so carbon-14 is what we use for radiocarbon dating. Okay, everyone's heard of carbon dating. So carbon-14 is a radioactive nucleus. It decays at a particular rate that we know. If we measure the amount of carbon-14 in something, we can figure out the time since it got into that something. Now, trees are particularly good for this. And what happens with these big solar storms, these, as we call them, sort of solar proton events, what happens is that they give rise to carbon-14 in the atmosphere. And that carbon-14 in the atmosphere is then incorporated into anything that's living. And then we can look at that much, much, much later on. So it gets incorporated into the trees, and we can measure the carbon-14. And what we're looking for are little spikes, okay? Because these solar storms give you more carbon-14 than is normally there. There's normally some carbon-14 in the atmosphere. These solar storms give you little spikes, and you can sort of then date them according to the trees, so the, you know, dendrochronology, so the tree rings, et cetera, et cetera. And you can sort of narrow things down pretty well. So what these Okinawa researchers did was, they went to northern Japan, and they measured the amount of carbon-14 in the trees. And then they looked at the old Japanese literature. So there was a Japanese writer in the year 1204 who said that he saw, quote, red lights in the sky over Kyoto. And so they were sort of thinking, well, you know, maybe this was due to a solar proton event. And so they did their C14 measurements, et cetera, dated it from the trees, found out that, yeah, that's pretty close to 1204. So they reckon between, as I said, the winter of 1200 and the spring of 1201. And also this was backed up by Chinese literature as well, because the Chinese had made some observations of these weird red skies as well that were due to sort of a, you know, a solar storm, a solar proton event and everything. So this is a lovely match there of literature and science.
That's phenomenal.
It's really cool. Very, very nice.
It's always nice when, because it's like all the... There's a lot of parts there, right?
With the trees, and I
just think it's really cool to see those things working together, especially for something that happened, you know, 800 years ago.
A long time ago, yeah. But no, that's impressive stuff.
Hey, so. that's a win for science, if you ask me.
And literature. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And what do you have for us finally?
Finally, just sort of very, very quickly, let's talk droughts. You know, we probably don't really want to, because we've all experienced droughts in relatively recent times, and we know that they are not good for the country. They do literally cost the country billions. And look, hell, if it's not a drought these days, it's a flood or something like that. We seem, you know, our weather just seems to be all up and down and all over the place, doesn't it? Of recent, you know, the past 20-odd years or something like that.
Weather events are becoming worryingly common.
No, I absolutely don't disagree. So what people would really like to do, you know, would be to be able to predict droughts, you know, to be able to predict, oh, yeah, this could be a bad season, we'd better save the water, et cetera, et cetera. And so in order to do this, they use climate records, which are fantastically accurate, but they only really date back to the 1970s, okay? So this particular collection of climate data that that people use. So it's the relatively recent past. I mean, it might not seem so for you guys because you weren't born in 1970, but some of us, you know, were around then. So in the recent past, so we've had big droughts in 2007, 2008, and 2012, 2013. Big droughts. And again, you know, cost the country big money. However, if we go back a little bit more to last century, they certainly were not the biggest droughts by any stretch of the imagination. So we go back to the 20th century, and we find that we had way bigger droughts in 1914-15, 1907, 1908, and 1945-46. And so they were all much, much, much bigger droughts. So the worry is that if we are relying on relatively recent climate data in order to do these predictions and everything, you know, we might not be predicting the worst, let's say, because those droughts, those relatively recent droughts, you know, they were bad, but they weren't terrible, terrible like those three were.
We know we can have worse.
Yes. Yeah. So that's what needs to be brought in mind. So, and this was an article in The Conversation by workers at Waikato and Canterbury Universities. So I think that's, you know, just a good thing to think about, just to consider when we are looking ahead. We need to look back as well.
So,
yeah.
I mean, obviously it's good to be preventative with these sort of things if we can.
Absolutely, yes.
Thanks, Alan, for joining us. Thank you, MOTAT, and thank you, Science. Find out what the future of fitness looks like at Sports Tech, 23rd and 24th of May, a whole weekend of fun activities focused on the innovative world of sports technology.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
We'll be right back. Text it into 5395 with any of your thoughts on these pieces.
Plant your feet on the ground at Double Whammy on Saturday, May 30th for a special show from Cerebi celebrating their brand new album, Nothing Grows Here. And your chums at 95BFM have some tickets to give away to B-card holders. So keep those ears dialed into Drive for your cue to enter. Cerebi, Nothing Grows Here album tour. Double Whammy, Saturday, May 30th. Tickets on sale now from Under the Radar.
Once a week, on Saturday morning, a door in the 95BFM studio appears. If you walk through that door, past the old posters, past the hanging vines, birds in their nests, and old 95BFM merch, you'll come to a waterfall. And at the top of that waterfall is the Saturday Spring. The Saturday Spring with Karen Hay. Chats, tunes, and everything you need to dive into the weekend. Saturday mornings, 9 till 11, only on 95BFM.
Audio. Culture.
Tune in to 95BFM Drive every second Tuesday as they're joined by one of our friends from Audio Culture, sharing the songs, stories and salacious scandal from which is woven the mighty tapestry of New Zealand music.
Audio Culture, more cultured than a blue cheese with a BA. Every other Tuesday on 95BFM Drive.
Thanks to Audio Culture. Iwi Waiata, the noisy library of New Zealand music. Go to audioculture.co.nz.
Quite a while, isn't it?
What are you up to these days?
Oh, keeping busy. How about you?
Oh, yeah. It's Kevin, isn't it?
What you call me?
Kevin. It's Kevin, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
John.
Mike.
Mike! Mike, yeah!
Oh, how you doing? I haven't seen you for... Oh, how you doing? I haven't seen you for...
Oh, how you doing? I haven't seen you for...
Yeah, that's quite a while, isn't it?
Yeah, so what are you up to these days?
Oh, keeping busy. How about you?
Oh, you know. So, where are you living anyway?
Well, you'd hardly call it living. I've lost my job. I'm having quite a few emotional problems.
Well, Hamilton? Wellington? Palmerston North?
Greyland. It's nice out there, eh?
Yeah.
Oh, how you doing? I haven't seen you for... Oh, how you doing? I haven't seen you for...
Quite a while, isn't it?
I suppose you're married with a family and everything by now, eh?
Oh, no, no way. Not me.
Still, only a matter of time, eh?
Nah.
Yeah, eh?
Nah.
Yeah, eh?
Nah.
Yeah, eh?
Nah.
Nah.
Yeah, eh?
Nah.
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 Yeah, eh?
Oh, how you doing? I haven't seen you for... How you doing? I haven't seen you for... How you doing? I haven't seen you for...
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with National MP Ryan Hamilton.
Last week, National MP Catherine Wedd's members' bill for an under-16s social media ban was paused. Instead, Education Minister Erica Stanford has pledged to, before this year's election, bring a wider and more robust proposal for a ban in a larger bill. Last week also saw Prime Minister Christopher Luxon make comments about the National Party stance on immigration amidst criticised changes to compliance officer powers and previous spats and comments over immigration policy between government coalition partners. And with the budget expected next week, promises have begun to be made by the government for where funding can be expected, particularly within education. I spoke with National MP Ryan Hamilton about these topics, starting with the social media ban. Where does this leave us on kind of this ban and what we might see in it from the National Party?
Yeah, I think Erica spoke really well on Jack Tame on Sunday about it too, just in terms of giving any, you know, a sense of where it's at. So essentially, the government's very aware of the need to do something, and we've been taking our time to make sure that we provide something that's going to be measured. You know, we're looking at overseas examples, we're looking at what's working or what hasn't worked so well. So we're trying to come up with something that we believe will be more comprehensive and encompassing. So, hopefully we'll have more information to share soon.
Are we seeing a kind of shape start to form around this bill, at least, in terms of whether or not it's reflecting Wedd's bill or kind of building on the Select Committee process?
Yeah, I think so. I think there were key learnings. Obviously, they went through that. That certainly, nothing was wasted through that process. In fact, it would have given key insights. The House had a two-hour debate on that actual inquiry last week. And I think there's broad consensus across the House, excluding the Greens, I understand, but, across from Labor as well. So hopefully we can get something that that will be enduring, and obviously the more support across the House, the better. But certainly from the government perspective, we've said that we will release something before the election.
Does the kind of support that the government is getting around this bill change the timeline at all? Is it likely to be sooner because different parties are supporting it? Or is it more of a, maybe we can put some more thought and some more time into this post-election?
I think it's been a combination of everything. You know, there was obviously the members' bill from Catherine Wedd. There was a motion or inquiry desire from that party. And then there was obviously the work that the minister was doing. And so it's just, I guess, trying to provide a cohesive framework which all of those positions can be reflected. And obviously that process, we are in a rush because, you know, it's important that it has a meaningful impact on what are, you know, hugely significant international companies. So that process has been worked through. I don't think it's been slowed unduly. It's just to make sure we get it right, and we're expecting a first reading, hopefully for the next few months. There will definitely be a first reading paper before the election. The whole process will no doubt take longer and will flow into the next term, I imagine. That's not for me to confirm, but I think given the amount of feedback and the Select Committee process, we'd want to make sure it's pretty robust and enduring.
If this bill does go through before the election, could we see some more work from maybe a future national government looking at how social media impacts young people and other areas that we can potentially make changes?
Not for sure. I mean, this bill, the first reading will definitely go before the election. That's been a commitment made by the Prime Minister and Erica Stanford. But once it goes through the Select Committee process, obviously there can be insights gained, and you know, the initial draft legislation can sometimes get tweaked. I mean, that's, I guess, the whole point of Select Committees, that stakeholders, the community, parents, teachers, schools, you know, can have a say and shape it and or, you know, contribute to unintended consequences with the way it's currently drafted or not drafted. So, but I think also going forward, I mean, the world we're living in is, and of course there was Laura McClure's deep fake stuff, which is going through the House at the moment. So it's such a dynamic space, you know, it might be that in another 5 years, I'm sure they'll have a built-in review period, actually. So there'll be a period where they'll review it and compare it to, is it still fit for purpose? Do we need some amendments? Because that, as you appreciate, that social media and technological landscape, particularly now AI, is moving so fast. It's always going to be a challenge for legislation to match it. So we've got to, you know, always be keeping an eye on how we reconcile, you know, ensuring the more vulnerable members of our community remain safe.
Moving on, the Prime Minister in his pre-budget address last week touched on the National Party wanting to have a careful approach to immigration. This comes after a proposed change that would allow compliance officers the powers to question suspected overstayers. With that change, at least, or that proposed change, what does the government kind of hope to get out of changes like this?
Well, we've got to make sure, firstly, that our immigration policy is fit for purpose. And, you know, before we took office and sort of post-COVID, there was, you know, the floodgates were essentially opened and, you know, overwhelmed our system, and there was a complete lack of robust checks and balances. And, you know, that puts huge pressure on our schooling system, it puts pressure on our housing system. And so there's been a clear reset from the minister around getting the balance right in terms of attracting and making sure systems are in place that attract high-skilled, you know, people to the economy. And obviously that's been flushed out through the trade agreement as well. You know, ICT professionals, engineers, nurses, people that are going to add and contribute to New Zealand society and to the workforce. And so, yeah, it's just about getting that balance right and helping our economy to grow, but in a way that's, you know, everyone's got to contribute.
And what does the government say to concerns maybe about the way that some of these powers could be wielded, at least when we look at other countries that have had highly publicised kind of crackdowns on immigration like the US?
Oh, I mean, I think clearly with two completely different jurisdictions under, you know, two, you know, highly different political and leadership systems and with different pressure points. Ours is going to be, you know, much more measured and focused on ensuring that, you know, the right policy is in place. It's not a crackdown to, you know, cause undue harm, but we've got to have, if we can't have policies and then enforce those policies, you know, the policies become meaningless. So we've got to get that balance right of good policy, but, you know, enforcement and execution of those policies as well.
And so looking at that, the Prime Minister's obviously specified a careful approach kind of going forward to the politicised issue of immigration. Are there any kind of existing plans about what might be done farther than this in terms of what that careful approach actually means, what areas the government might look at?
Yeah, I think just to reiterate, I mean, we're looking at individuals where we've got shortages of skill sets. You know, we've said clearly that the changes we've made recently strengthen our immigration system to prioritise those skilled migrants through higher English language requirements, but more enforcement and tougher penalties. But equally, you know, there's been a few agencies in New Zealand that were exploiting, you know, some of the migrant opportunities. So it's also something that we're keeping an eye on as well.
And finally, looking forward, the budget is obviously on the horizon with these comments being made at the pre-budget address. What can we expect from the government with this budget in terms of the main focus points and changes that we might see?
I think you and I are both excited to wait and see. I think there's about 11 fleets to go, but obviously we've seen a few announcements around the education policy and promoting and supporting more resources through our primary school, you know, teachers and students with you know, the resources they need. Today, Nicola Willis will be giving a speech on perhaps refinements around the public service and reducing some of the government overheads in the public service space and looking for more efficiencies. But other than that, Thursday next week is going to be an exciting day. What is that, 9 or 10 more sleeps?
And I mean, just final question kind of on the budget. The economy is in a little bit of a volatile position, looking towards, you know, international developments and events. But kind of going into this election year and releasing what could be the final national budget of this government, is the National Party confident in this budget as kind of really getting a grip on what should be happening in the New Zealand economy?
I have confidence that through Minister Nicola Willis and our Prime Minister that it will be a very good budget, if anything, by the last two are to go by. She's got a very tough, you know, position of balancing the needs, the growing needs of New Zealanders around health, education and infrastructure, but equally balancing, you know, our fiscal headroom in the debt burden that we've inherited. So it's always going to be a balance. But I think the messaging we've sent is very clear, is that we're going to provide something that, and as to the Prime Minister's comments, we need to build our buffers in the increasing world of, you know, volatility. New Zealand has to ensure that we're not going increasing debt, because those capital markets could change and New Zealand could be left very exposed. So I think we're going to see a very sensible budget that tries to address all of those things, and in the backdrop of a fuel crisis as well.
That was National MP Ryan Hamilton on the social media ban, national stance on immigration and the upcoming budget.
That was our weekly chat with National MP Ryan Hamilton.
We'll be right back.
Shadow hypnotize me with every
That was Hard Evidence by Ringlets and Better To Be by Liam Finn, and Way Back Before Ryan was How Are You Doing by The Front Lawn. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM.
What's this button do? Whoa!
You are now entering the green world.
Since 1986, the Ministry for the Environment has been the central policy advising entity in New Zealand for environmental issues. The government has recently proposed the Environment Amendment Bill, which seeks to disestablish the Ministry for the Environment, which would be amalgamated into a larger ministry for cities, environment, regions and transport. For Green World this week, I spoke with Professor Nicholas Lewis of the University of Auckland's School for Environment about these proposed changes, how they fit in with the government's current priorities around the environment, and the impact this may have on New Zealand in the short and long term. So the Ministry for the Environment has been around since 1986. Why is it so important to have a body and structure dedicated to the environment?
See, what the Ministry is able to do is consider over a long period of time, so it's able to build over 30 years now, a body of understandings about the environment, a body of understandings about things that need to be prioritised when decisions are made that involve the environment, a collection of expertise and institutional memory. All of these things add up to an ability to act as a democratic institution and in the functioning of government. The ministry is not set up to be a voice for the environment, but to be a place where matters of the environment are considered independently of other considerations, so that when overall decisions are made, what is important to the environment is firmly on the table.
And what is the government's reasoning behind removing the Ministry for the Environment?
One can only imagine that it's related to two things, three things maybe. I would say the first is it does away with some of the contention around fast-tracking development processes. So it allows government to have a far more direct control over the development process, which takes away some of the delays associated with approving consents to use resources, delays that on the one hand may be unnecessary red tape, but are generally appropriate delays to consider questions that are important to wider communities and to the environment over a long period of time. So that removal of obstruction to developer and government imperatives is probably the primary reason. The second reason is it allows government to concentrate control over processes and to streamline decisions that come from the centre of government into sort of enacted policy through the spending of money and investment in infrastructure on the government's part, but also to expedite development processes on the part of investors.
Looking to the short term, what sort of effects do you expect to see this ministry is disestablished?
In the short term, I expect to see wherever there is capital available, wherever there is investment money, looking for an outlet in around New Zealand resources. I expect approvals to be expedited. So barriers to the development process. But I don't actually expect to see that result in investment, because I don't think the country is geared up to be able to invest quickly. So what you will probably see fastest is development processes on the outskirts of Auckland, development within Auckland City. You will see some of the government's plans around mining and large-scale infrastructure projects be streamlined. So you'll see plans in place, I think, for investment rather than necessarily investment. But you'll also see a change of developer culture, which is a worrying thing in that the presumption will now be that anything is possible.
Yeah, and how can we expect this move to play out in the long term?
The longer term is more worrying because it may take some significant time to assemble the pools of capital from international financial vehicles or even domestically configured pools of finance to become investment ready. But once that is ready, I think we should expect to see a concentration of investment in farming around the country. I think we should expect to see land that's previously not been brought into full production being brought into production. I think we should expect to see some large scale developments on the edges of our cities. We will see some mining exploration, although it's uncertain. It's uncertain how successful that exploration will be in terms of long-term mining operations. I think what we might see now is some more economically marginal mining get the go-ahead. But more significantly than any of those things, I think we'll see ownership of property concentrate into fewer hands, with the expectation that development is possible at any moment. So preparation for grow, maybe, rather than immediate growth.
And how do you see the ministry operating under a new combined Ministry of Cities, Environment, Regions and Transport?
That's the worrying factor. When you do amalgamate ministries, and for that matter, disciplines within universities, into mega schools, what you create is the ability for more streamlined control from the centre. So that's the general outcome of these things. And that's why they do it, in effect, to centralise control around claims to do with efficiency. There's little proof that there will be more efficient decision making in terms of final outcomes on the landscape, but there is every evidence suggests that the control will be streamlined. So in the hands of a government that is dedicated to growth, you will see concerns with the environment deprioritized. You will see the other three dimensions of the ministry are essentially growth-oriented dimensions. So you're putting the environment inside of those concerns. So in terms of environmental protection, considerations will be driven toward, very much towards, a growth within limits approach to environmental management, and those limits will be pushed upon on a daily basis. I think that's the kind of main concern. We've seen some of this within MBIE, where the science system has lost its independence and has now been very much made subject to the demands of innovation and economic development. So there is precedent in the New Zealand setting and in the New Zealand government setting for these mega ministries to silence potentially voices that would have the world be otherwise. My big concern about all of this is that it's yet another institution and point site moment in the democratic process where alternative views of what this country might look like and how we might generate our livelihoods and how we might reproduce our social infrastructure. But it's yet another one of those sites and moments that is disappearing on us. So a loss of opportunity for people to participate in their own futures and in the design and execution of their own futures, and a loss of opportunity to float alternative visions of the future into decision-making contexts.
Yeah. Well, what is the public's view on these proposed changes?
Well, it's hard for me to answer that question. Obviously, you've seen, and we've all seen, an outcry from the social media and people based in universities and CRIs and people involved in NGOs, because this is the latest step in a series of changes associated with fast-tracking resource consents and so on. And all along the way, there has been a great deal of opposition through those circuits. It's a little bit hard to tell how that opposition, what little opposition there is out there beyond those who are social media users. There has been a lot of opposition in social media, but what that says about the general mood of the public is difficult to read.
Was this a foreseeable move based on the previous handling of the environment by the government?
I think this was foreseeable. The government is very much concerned to overhaul the reform of the RMA that was already in place. So the Resource Management Act, which is at the heart of much of this, and the teeth that the Ministry of the Environment believes that the Ministry of the Environment can pull, to the extent that government might be looking to completely overhaul resource management law, yes, it is completely foreseeable. They would need a different entity to do that if they wanted to backseat the environment.
And how does this move make New Zealand look on an international stage?
That's another unfortunate thing. The immaterial that I've read in various sorts of literature, the Ministry for the Environment, the New Zealand Environmental Regulatory Framework more generally, is looked upon as a bit of an exemplar as to how you can build a voice for the environment into routine policy making and decision making. And I think that loss is a significant one. We tend to underestimate the importance of the international view of New Zealand, both in narrow economic terms, in terms of tourism and so on, but also in more general terms of how our young people might get jobs in other parts of the world, how our diplomatic endeavours are seen and the way in which we've become a significant international actor. All these things, such as, you know, our relationship with the environment, our democratic structure, our regulatory arrangements, are all part of those dimensions. And at a time in particular when so many young people are being driven overseas to find employment, this sense of how important our nation is, how well it is seen abroad, is an important part in whether young people get jobs overseas.
That was the University of Auckland's Professor Nicholas Lewis speaking about the government's proposed removal of the Ministry for the Environment.
That was The Green World.
That was The Wire.
Ko I rate o taka katoa mō tēnei wiki. Nei te mihi ki a rātou I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Tuesday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Professor Alan Blackman, National MP Ryan Hamilton, and Professor Nicholas Lewis from the University of Auckland. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou I whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up, we've got the 1-4 with Jin.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.